pills. They're Healthwiser over-the-counter premium brand, you know? They have a really elegant delivery system. They embed a virus inside a carrier bacterium, E. coli splice, doesn't get digested, bursts into the pylorus, and bingo. Random insertion, of course, and they don't have to keep on doing it. If they did, they'd get caught, because even in the plebelands, they've got guys who could figure it out. But once you've got a hostile bioform started in the plebe population, the way people slosh around out there, it more or less runs itself. Naturally, they develop the antidotes at the same time as they're customizing the bugs, but they hold those in reserve. They practice the economics of scarcity, so they're guaranteed high profits. "Are you making this up?" said Jimmy. "The best diseases from a business point of view," said Craig, "would be those that cause lingering illnesses. Ideally, that is, for maximum profit, the patient should either get well or die just before all of his or her money runs out. It's a fine calculation." "This would be really evil," said Jimmy. "That's what my father thought," said Craig. "He knew?" Jimmy really was paying attention now. "He found out. That's how come they pushed him off a bridge."
"Who did?" said Jimmy.
"Into oncoming traffic."
"Are you going paranoid or what?"
"Not in the least," said Craig. "This is the bare naked truth. I hacked into my dad's emails before they deep-cleansed his computer. The evidence he'd been collecting was all there. The tests he'd been running on the vitamin pills. Everything."
Jimmy felt a chill up his spine. "Who knows that you know?"
"Guess who else he told," said Craig. "My mother and Uncle Pete. He was going to do some whistleblowing through a rogue website. Those things have a wide viewership. It would have wrecked the plebland sales of every single Healthwiser vitamin supplement. Plus it would have torched the entire scheme. It would have caused financial havoc. Think of the job losses." "He wanted to warn them first." Craig paused. "He thought Uncle Pete didn't know."
"Wow," said Jimmy.
"So one or the other of them."
"Could have been both," said Craig.
"Uncle Pete wouldn't have wanted the bottom line threatened. My mother may just have been scared, felt that if my dad went down, she could go too. Or it could have been the Corpsichore. Maybe he'd been acting funny at work, maybe they were checking up. He encrypted everything, but if I could hack in, so could they."
"That is so weird," said Jimmy. "So they murdered your father?"
"Executed," said Craig. "That's what they'd have called it. They'd have said he was about to destroy an elegant concept. They'd have said they were acting for the general good." The two of them sat there. Craig was looking up at the ceiling, almost as if he admired it. Jimmy didn't know what else to say. Words of comfort would be superfluous. Finally, Craig said, "How come your mother took off the way she did?"
"I don't know," said Jimmy. "A lot of reasons. I don't want to talk about it."
"I bet your dad was in on something like that. Some scam like the Healthwiser one. I bet she found out."
"Oh, I don't think so," said Jimmy. "I think she got involved with some God's Gardeners type outfit. Some bunch of wackos. Anyway, my dad wouldn't have..."
"I bet she knew they were starting to know she knew."
"I'm really tired," said Jimmy. He yawned, and suddenly it was true. "I think I'll turn in."
Extinctathon.
On the last evening, Craig said, "Want to play Extinctathon?"
"Extinctathon," said Jimmy.
It took him a moment, but then he remembered it. The boring web interactive with all those defunct animals and plants.
"When was it we used to play that? It can't still be going."
"It's never stopped," said Craig. Jimmy took in the implications. Craig had never stopped. He must have been playing it by himself all these years. Well, he was a compulsive, no news there.
"So how's your cumulative score?" he asked, to be polite.
"Once you rack up 3,000," said Craig, "you get to be a grandmaster." Which meant Craig was one, because he wouldn't have mentioned it otherwise.
"Oh, good," said Jimmy. "So do you get a prize? The tail and both ears?"
"Let me show you something," said Craig. He went onto the web, found the site, pulled it up. There was the familiar gateway.
Extinctathon, monitored by Mad Adam. Adam named the living animals, Mad Adam names the dead ones. Do you want to play?
Craig clicked yes and entered his code name, Rednecked Craig.
The little coelacanth symbol appeared over his name, meaning Grandmaster.
Then something new came up, a message Jimmy had never seen before. "Welcome, Grandmaster Rednecked Crake. Do you want to play a general game, or do you want to play another Grandmaster?" Crake clicked the second. "Good. Find your playroom. Mad Adam will meet you there." "Mad Adam is a person?" asked Jimmy.
"It's a group," said Crake. "Or groups."
"So what do they do, this Mad Adam?" Jimmy was feeling silly. It was like watching some corny old spy DVD, James Bond or something. Besides counting the skulls and pelts, I mean.
"Watch this."
Crake left Extinctathon, then hacked into a local plebe bank, and from there skipped to what looked to be a manufacturer of solar car parts. He went into the image of a hubcap, which opened into a folder. Hot Tots Pinups, it was titled. The files were dated, not named. He chose one of them, transferred it into one of his lily pads, used that to skip to another, erased his footprints, opened the file there, loaded an image. It was the picture of Oryx, 7 or 8 years old, naked except for her ribbons, her flowers. It was the picture of the look she'd given him, the direct, contemptuous, knowing look that had dealt him such a blow when he was, what, 14? He still had the paper printout folded up, hidden deep. It was a private thing, this picture, his own private thing, his own guilt, his own shame, his own desire. Why had Crake kept it? Stolen it. Jimmy felt ambushed. "What's she doing here?" he wanted to yell. "That's mine. Give it back." He was in a lineup, fingers pointed at him, faces scowled while some rabid Bernice clone set fire to his undershorts. Retribution was at hand, but for what? What had he done? Nothing. He'd only looked. Crake moved to the girl's left eye, clicked on the iris. It was a gateway. The playroom opened up. "Hello, Grandmaster Crake. Enter pass number now." Crake did so. A new sentence popped up. "Adam named the animals. Mad Adam customizes them." Then there was a string of e-bulletins with places and dates. Corpsichore issue by the look of them, marked for secure addresses only. A tiny parasitic wasp had invaded several Chicky Knob's installations, carrying a modified form of chickenpox specific to the Chicky Knob and fatal to it. The installations had had to be incinerated before the epidemic could be brought under control. A new form of the common house mouse, addicted to the insulation on electric wiring, had overrun Cleveland, causing an unprecedented number of house fires. Control measures were still being tested. Happy Cup of coffee bean crops were menaced by a new bean weevil, found to be resistant to all known pesticides. A miniature rodent containing elements of both porcupine and beaver had appeared in the Northwest, creeping under the hoods of parked vehicles and devastating their fan belts and transmission systems. A microbe that ate the tar and asphalt had turned several interstate highways to sand. All interstates were on alert, and a quarantine belt was now in place.
"What's going on?" said Jimmy. "Who's putting this stuff out there?"
The bulletins vanished, and a fresh entry appeared. "Mad Adam needs fresh initiatives. Got a bright idea? Share with us." Crake typed, "Sorry, interruption. Must go." "Right, Grandmaster Rednecked Crake. We'll talk later." Crake closed down. Jimmy had a cold feeling, a feeling that reminded him of the time his mother had left home. The same sense of the forbidden, of a door swinging open that ought to be kept locked, of a stream of secret lives running underground, in the darkness just beneath his feet. "What was that all about?" he said. It might not be anything, he told himself. It might be about Crake showing off. It might be an elaborate setup, an invention of Crake's, a practical joke to frighten him.
"I'm not sure," said Crake. "I thought at first they were just another crazy animal liberation org, but there's more to it than that. I think they're after the machinery. They're after the whole system. They want to shut it down. So far they haven't done any people numbers, but it's obvious they could."
"You shouldn't be messing around," said Jimmy. "You don't want to be connected. Someone could think you're a part of it. What if you get caught? You'll end up on brain frizz." He was frightened now.
"I won't get caught," said Crake. "I'm just cruising. But do me a favor and don't mention this when you email."
"Sure," said Jimmy. "But why even take the chance?"
"I'm curious, that's all," said Crake. "They've let me into the waiting room, but not any further. They've got to be compound, or compound-trained. These are sophisticated bioforms they're putting together.
I don't think a pleblander would be able to make anything like that. He gave Jimmy his green-eyed, sideways look. A look, Snowman thinks now, that meant trust. Craik trusted him. Otherwise, he wouldn't have shown him the hidden playroom.
It could be a Corpsichor flytrap, said Jimmy.
The corpsmen were in the habit of setting up schemes of that sort, to capture subversives in the making. Weeding the pea patch, he'd heard it called. The compounds were said to be mined with such potentially lethal tunnels.
You need to watch your step.
Sure, said Craik. What Jimmy really wanted to know was, out of all the possibilities you had, out of all the gateways, why did you choose her? He couldn't ask, though. He couldn't give himself away. Something else happened during that visit, something important, though Jimmy hadn't realized it at the time. The first night, as he was sleeping on Craik's pull-out sofa bed, he'd heard shouting. He'd thought it was coming from outside. At Martha Graham it would have been student pranksters. But in fact it was coming from Craik's room. It was coming from Craik. More than shouting. Screaming. There were no words. It happened every night he was there.
That was some dream you were having, said Jimmy the next morning, after the first time it happened.
I never dream, said Craik. His mouth was full and he was looking out the window. For such a thin man, he ate a lot. It was the speed, the high metabolic rate. Craik burned things up.
Everyone dreams, Jimmy said.
Remember the REM sleep study at Healthwiser High?
The one where we tortured cats?
Virtual cats, yeah. And the cats that couldn't dream went crazy?
I never remember my dreams, said Craik.
Have some more toast.
But you must have them anyway.
Okay, point taken, wrong words. I didn't mean I never dream. I'm not crazy, therefore I must dream. Hypothesis, demonstration, conclusion. If A, then not B. Good enough?
Craik smiled, poured himself some coffee.
So Craik never remembered his dreams. It's Snowman that remembers them instead. Worse than remembers. He's immersed in them. He's wading through them. He's stuck in them. Every moment he's lived in the past few months was dreamed first by Craik. No wonder Craik screamed so much. 9. Hike. After an hour of walking, Snowman comes out from the former park. He picks his way farther inland, heading along the trashed plebland boulevards and avenues and roads and streets. Wrecked solar cars are plentiful, some piled up in multi-vehicle crashes, some burnt out, some standing intact as if temporarily parked. There are trucks and vans, fuel cell models, and also the old gas or diesel kind, and ATVs. A few bicycles, a few motorcycles. Not a bad choice, considering the traffic mayhem that must have lasted for days. On a two-wheeled item, you'd have been able to weave in and out among the larger vehicles until someone shot you, or ran into you, or you fell off. This was once a semi-residential sector. Shops on the ground floor, gutted now. Small, dim apartments above. Most of the signs are still in place, despite the bullet holes in them. People had hoarded the lead bullets from the time before spray guns, despite the ban on the plebes having any kind of gun at all. Snowman's been unable to find any bullets. Not that he'd had a rusty old firearm that would have taken them. The buildings that didn't burn or explode are still standing, though the botany is thrusting itself through every crack. Given time, it will fissure the asphalt, topple the walls, push aside the roofs. Some kind of vine is growing everywhere, draping the windowsills, climbing in through the broken windows and up the bars and grillwork. Soon this district will be a thick tangle of vegetation. If he'd postponed the trip much longer, the way back would have become impassable. It won't be long before all visible traces of human habitation will be gone. But suppose, just suppose, thinks Snowman, that he's not the last of his kind. Suppose there are others. He wills them into being, these possible remnants who might have survived in isolated pockets, cut off by the shutdown of the communications networks, keeping themselves alive somehow. Monks in desert hideaways, far from contagion. Mountain goat herders who'd never mixed with the valley people. Lost tribes in the jungles. Survivalists who'd tuned in early, shot all comers, sealed themselves into their underground bunkers. Hillbillies, recluses, wandering lunatics swathed in protective hallucinations. Bands of nomads following their ancient ways. How did this happen, their descendants will ask, stumbling upon the evidence, the ruins, the ruinous evidence. Who made these things? Who lived in them? Who destroyed them? The Taj Mahal, the Louvre, the pyramids, the Empire State Building. Stuff he's seen on TV, in old books, on postcards, on blood and roses. Imagine coming upon them, 3D, life-sized, with no preparation. You'd be freaked. You'd run away. And after that, you'd need an explanation. At first, they'll say giants or gods, but sooner or later, they'll want to know the truth. Like him, they'll have the curious monkey brain. Perhaps they'll say, these things are not real. They are phantasmagoria. They were made by dreams, and now that no one is dreaming them any longer, they are crumbling away.
Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, said Craik one evening, that civilization as we know it gets destroyed. Want some popcorn?
Is that real butter? Said Jimmy.
Nothing but the best at Watson Crick, said Craik.
Once it's flattened, it could never be rebuilt.
Because why? Got any salt?
Because all the available surface metals have already been mined, said Craik. Without which, no Iron Age, no Bronze Age, no Age of Steel, and all the rest of it. There's metals farther down, but the advanced technology we need for extracting those would have been obliterated.
It could have been put back together, said Jimmy, chewing. It was so long since he'd tasted popcorn this good. They'd still have the instructions.
Actually not, said Craik. It's not like the wheel. It's too complex now. Suppose the instructions survived. Suppose there were any people left with the knowledge to read them. Those people would be few and far between. And they wouldn't have the tools. Remember, no electricity. Then, once those people died, that would be it. They'd have no apprentices. They'd have no successors. Want a beer? Is it cold?
All it takes, said Craik, is the elimination of one generation. One generation of anything. Beetles, trees, microbes, scientists, speakers of French, whatever. Break the link in time between one generation and the next, and it's game over forever.
Speaking of games, said Jimmy, it's your move.
The walking has become an obstacle course for Snowman. In several places he's needed to make detours. Now he's in a narrow side street, choked with mines. They've festooned themselves across the street, from roof to roof. Through the clefts in the overhead greenery, he can see a handful of vultures circling idly in the sky. They can see him, too. They have eyesight like 10 magnifying glasses. Those things can count the change in your pocket. He knows a thing or two about vultures.
Not yet, he calls up at them.
But why disappoint them? If he were to stumble and fall, cut himself open, knock himself out, then be set upon by wolvogs or pigoons, what difference would it make to anyone but himself? The Krakers are doing fine. They don't need him anymore. For a while they'll wonder where he's gone, but he's already provided an answer to that. He's gone to be with Craik. He'll become a secondary player in their mythology, such as it is, a sort of backup demiurge. He'll be falsely remembered. He won't be mourned. The sun is climbing higher, intensifying its rays. He feels lightheaded. A thick tendril slithers away, flickering its tongue, as his foot comes down beside it. He needs to pay more attention. Are any of the snakes venomous? Did that long tail he almost stepped on have a small, furry body at the front? He didn't see it clearly. He certainly hopes not. The claim was that all the snats had been destroyed, but it would take only one pair of them. One pair, the Adam and Eve of snats, and some weirdo with a grudge, bidding them go forth and multiply, relishing the idea of those things twirling up the drain pipes. Rats with long, green, scaly tails and rattlesnake fangs. He decides not to think about that. Instead, he begins to hum, to cheer himself up. What's the song? Winter Wonderland. They used to recycle that in the malls every Christmas, long after the last time it snowed. Some tune about playing pranks on a snowman before it got mushed. Maybe he's not the abominable snowman after all. Maybe he's the other kind of snowman, the grinning dope set up as a joke and pushed down as an entertainment, his pebble smile and carrot nose an invitation to mockery and abuse. Maybe that's the real him, the last Homo sapiens, a white illusion of a man, here today, gone tomorrow. So easily shoved over, left to melt in the sun,
getting thinner and thinner until he liquefies and trickles away altogether, as Snowman is doing now. He pauses, wipes the sweat off his face, drinks half of his bottle of water. He hopes there will be more somewhere. Soon. Up ahead, the houses thin out and vanish. There's an interval of parking lots and warehouses, then barbed wire strung between cement posts, an elaborate gate off its hinges. End of urban sprawl and plebe city limits, beginning of compound turfdom. Here's the last station of the sealed tunnel bullet train, with its plastic jungle gym colors. No risks here, the colors are saying. Just kiddie fun. But this is the dangerous part. Up to here, he's always had something he could climb, or scramble up, or dodge around in case of a flank attack. But now comes an open space with no shelter and few verticals. He pulls the sheet up over his baseball cap to protect himself from the sun's glare, shrouding himself like an Arab, and plods on, picking up the pace as much as he can. He knows he'll burn some even through the sheet if he stays out here long enough. His best hope is speed. He'll need to get to shelter before noon, when the asphalt will be too hot to walk on. Now he's reached the compounds. He passes the turnoff to Cryogenius, one of the smaller outfits. He'd like to have been a fly on the wall when the lights went out and 2,000 frozen millionaires' heads awaiting resurrection began to melt in the dark. Next comes Genie Gnomes, with the elfin mascot popping its pointy-eared head in and out of a test tube. The neon was on, he noted. The solar hookup must still be functioning, though not perfectly. Those signs were supposed to go on only at night. And finally, Rejuvenescence, where he'd made so many mistakes. Misunderstood so much, gone on his last joyride. Bigger than Organ Ink Farms, bigger than Healthwiser, the biggest of them all. He passes the first barricade with its crapped-out scopers and busted searchlights, then the checkpoint booth. A guard is lying half in, half out. Snowman isn't too surprised by the absence of a head. In times of crisis, emotions run high. He checks to see if the guy still has his spray gun, but no dice. Next comes a tract kept free of buildings. No man's land, Craig used to call it. No trees here. They'd mowed down anything you could hide behind, divided the territory into squares with lines of heat and motion sensors. The eerie chessboard effect is already gone. Weeds are poking up like whiskers all over the flat surface. Snowman takes a few minutes to scan the field, but apart from a cluster of dark birds squabbling over some object on the ground, nothing's moving. Then he goes forward. Now he's on the approach proper. Along the road is a trail of objects people must have dropped in flight, like a treasure hunt in reverse. A suitcase, a knapsack spilling out clothes and trinkets, an overnight bag, broken open, beside it a forlorn pink toothbrush. A bracelet, a woman's hair ornament in the shape of a butterfly. A notebook, its pages soaked, the handwriting illegible. The fugitives must have had hope to begin with. They must have thought they'd have a use for these things later. Then they'd changed their minds and let go. Rejuvenescence. He's out of breath and sweating too much by the time he reaches the Rejuvenescence compound curtain wall, still 12 feet high but no longer electrified, its iron spikes rusting. He goes through the outer gate, which looks as if someone blew it apart, pausing in its shadow to eat the chocolate energy bar and drink the rest of his water. Then he continues on, across the moat, past the sentry boxes where the Corpsichore armed guards once stood and the glassed-in cubicles where they'd monitored the surveillance equipment, then past the rampart watchtower with the steel door, standing forever open now, where he'd once have been ordered to present his thumbprint and the iris of his eye. Beyond is the vista he remembers so well. The residences laid out like a garden suburb, with large houses and fake Georgian and fake Tudor and fake French provincial, the meandering streets leading to the employees' golf course, and their restaurants and nightclubs and medical clinics and shopping malls and indoor tennis courts, and their hospitals. To the right are the off-bounds hot bioform isolation facilities, bright orange, and the black, cube-shaped, shatterproof glass fortresses that were the business end of things. In the distance is his destination, the Central Park,
with the top of Crake's charmed dome visible above the trees, round and white and glaring, like a bubble of ice. Looking at it, he shivers. But no time for pointless repining. He hikes rapidly along the main street, stepping around the huddles of cloth and gnawed human carcasses. Not much left except the bones. The scavengers have done their work. At the time he walked out of here, this place looked like a riot scene and stank like an abattoir. But now all is quiet, and the stench is mostly gone. The pigoons have rooted up the lawns, their hoof marks are everywhere, though luckily not too fresh. His first object is food. It would make sense to go all the way along the road to where the malls are, more chance of a square meal there, but he's too hungry for that. Also, he needs to get out of the sun, right now. So he takes the second left, into one of the residential sections. Already the weeds are thick along the curbs. The street is circular. In the island in the middle, a clutch of shrubs, unpruned and scraggly, flares with red and purple flowers. Some exotic splice. In a few years they'll be overwhelmed. Or else they'll spread, make inroads, choke out the native plants. Who can tell which? The whole world is now one vast, uncontrolled experiment. The way it always was, Crake would have said. And the doctrine of unintended consequences is in full spate. The house he chooses is medium-sized, a Queen Anne. The front door's locked, but a diamond-paned window has been smashed. Some doomed looter must have been there before him. Snowman wonders what the poor guy was looking for. Food, useless money, or just a place to sleep. Whatever it wouldn't have done him much good. He drinks a few handfuls of water from a stone birdbath, ornamented with witless-looking frogs and still mostly full from yesterday's downpour, and not too muddied with bird droppings. What disease do birds carry, and is it in their shit? He'll have to chance it. After splashing his face and neck, he refills his bottle. Then he studies the house for signs, for movements. He can't rid himself of the notion that someone like him, is lying in wait around some corner, behind some half-open door. He takes off his sunglasses, knots them into his sheet. Then he climbs in through the broken window, one leg and then the other, throwing his stick in first. Now he's in the dimness. The hair on his arms prickles. Claustrophobia and bad energy are already pressing him down. The air is thick, as if panic had condensed in here and hasn't yet had time to dissipate. It smells like a thousand bad drains. "Hello," he calls. "Anybody home?" He can't help it. Any house speaks to him of potential inhabitants. He feels like turning back. Nausea simmers in his throat. But he holds a corner of his rancid sheet over his nose, at least it's his own smell, and makes his way across the moldering broadloom, past the dim shapes of the plump reproduction furniture. There's a squeaking, a scurrying. The rats have taken over. He picks his steps with care. He knows what he looks like to rats. Carrion on the hoof. They sound like real rats, though, not snats. Snats don't squeak. They hiss. Did squeak. Did hiss, he corrects himself. They were liquidated. They're extinct. He must insist on that. First things first. He locates the liquor cabinet in the dining room and goes through it quickly. A half bottle of bourbon, nothing else, only a bunch of empties. No cigarettes. It must have been a non-smoking household, or else the looter before him pinched them. "Fuck you," he says to the fumed oak sideboard. Then he tiptoes up the carpeted stairs to the second floor. Why so quietly, as if he's a real burglar? He can't help it. Surely there are people here asleep. Surely they will hear him and wake up. But he knows that's foolish. There's a man in the bathroom, sprawled on the earth-tone tiles, wearing, what's left of him, a pair of blue and maroon striped pajamas. Strange, thinks Snowman, how in an emergency a lot of people would head for the bathroom. Bathrooms were the closest things to sanctuaries in these houses, places where you could be alone, to mediate. Also to puke, to bleed from the eyes, to shit your guts out, to grope desperately in the medicine cabinet for some pill that would save you. It's a nice bathroom, a jacuzzi, ceramic Mexican mermaids on the walls, their heads crowned with flowers, their blonde hair waving down, their painted nipples bright pink on breasts that are small but rounded.
He wouldn't mind a shower. This place probably has a gravity flow rainwater backup tank, but there's some form of hardened gook in the tub. He takes a bar of soap for later and checks the cabinet for sunblock without success. A Bliss Plus container, half full, a bottle of aspirin, which he snags. He thinks about adding a toothbrush, but he has an aversion to sticking a dead person's toothbrush into his mouth, so he takes only the toothpaste. "For a whiter smile," he reads. Fine with him. He needs a whiter smile, though he can't at the moment think what for. The mirror on the front of the cabinet has been smashed. Some last act of ineffectual rage, of cosmic protest. Why this? Why me? He can understand that. He'd have done the same. Broken something. Turned his last glimpse of himself into fragments. Most of the glass is in the sink, but he's careful where he places his feet. Like a horse, his life now depends on them. If he can't walk, he's rat food. He continues along the hall. The lady of the house is in the bedroom, tucked under the king-sized pink and gold duvet. One arm and shoulder blade outside the covers, bones and tendons in a leopard skin print nightie. Her face is turned away from him, which is just as well, but her hair is intact, all of a piece, as if it's a wig. Dark roots, frosted wisps, a sort of pixie look. On the right woman, that could be attractive. At one time in his life, he used to go through other people's bureau drawers given half the chance. But in this room, he doesn't want to. Anyway, it would be the same sort of thing. Underwear, sex aids, costume jewelry, mixed in with pencil stubs, spare change and safety pins, and a diary if he got lucky. When he was still in high school, he'd liked reading girls' diaries, with their capital letters and multiple exclamation marks and extreme phrasing, love, 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 hate, 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 and their colored underlining, like the crank letters he used to get later at work. He'd wait till the girl was in the shower, do a lightning-swift rummage. Of course it was his own name he'd be searching for, though he hadn't always liked what he'd found. Once he'd read, "Jimmy, you nosy brat, I know you're reading this. I hate it. Just because I fucked you doesn't mean I like you, so stay out." Two red lines under hate, three under stay out. Her name had been Brenda. Cute, a gum chewer, sat in front of him in life skills class. She'd had a solar battery robo-dog on her dresser that barked, fetched a plastic bone, and lifted its leg to pee yellow water. It's always struck him how the toughest and most bitchy girls had the schmaltziest, squishiest doodads in their bedrooms. The vanity table holds the standard collection of firming creams, hormone treatments, ampules and injections, cosmetics, colognes. In the half-light that comes through the slatted blinds, these things gleam darkly, like a still life muted with varnish. He sprays himself with the stuff in one of the bottles, a musky scent he hopes might cut the other smells in here. "Crack cocaine," its label says in raised gold lettering. He thinks briefly about drinking it, but remembers he has the bourbon. Then he bends down to take stock of himself in the oval mirror. He can't resist the mirrors in the places he breaks into. He sneaks a peek at himself every chance he has. Increasingly, it's a shock. A stranger stares back at him, bleary-eyed, hollow-cheeked, pocked with bug-bite scabs. He looks 20 years older than he is. He winks, grins at himself, sticks out his tongue. The effect is truly sinister. Behind him in the glass, the husk of the woman in the bed seems almost like a real woman, as if at any moment she might turn towards him, open her arms, whisper to him to come and get her. Her and her pixie hair. Oryx had a wig like that. She liked to dress up, change her appearance, pretend to be different women. She'd strut around the room, do a little strip wiggle and pose. She said men liked variety. "Who told you that?" Jimmy asked her. "Oh, someone." Then she laughed. That was right before he scooped her up and her wig fell off. "Jimmy!" But he can't afford to think about Oryx right now. He finds himself standing in the middle of the room, hands dangling, mouth open. "I have been unintelligent," he says out loud. Next door there's a child's room, with a computer in gay red plastic, a shelf of teddy bears, a wallpaper frieze of giraffes, and a stash of CDs containing, judging from the pictures on them, some extremely violent computer games. But there's no child, no child's body. Maybe it died and was cremated in those first few days when cremations were still taking place. Or maybe it was frightened when its parents keeled over and began gurgling blood, and it ran away somewhere else. Maybe it was one of the cloth and bone bundles he passed on the streets outside. Some of them were quite small. He locates the linen closet in the hall and exchanges his filthy sheet for a fresh one, this time not plain but patterned with scrolls and flowers. That will make an impression among the Craker kids. "Look," they'll say, "Snowman is growing leaves." They wouldn't put it past him. There's a whole stack of clean sheets in the closet, neatly folded, but he takes only the one. He doesn't want to weigh himself down with stuff he doesn't really need. If he has to, he can always come back for more. He hears his mother's voice telling him to put the discarded sheet into the laundry hamper. Old neurological pathways die hard, but he drops it onto the floor instead and goes back downstairs, into the kitchen. He hopes he'll find some canned food there, soy stew or beans and fake wieners, anything with protein in it. Even some vegetables would be nice, ersatz or not, he'll take anything. But whoever smashed the window also cleaned out the cupboard. There's a handful of dry cereal in a plastic snap-top container, so he eats that. It's unadulterated junk gene cardboard, and he has to chew it a lot and drink some water to get it down. He finds 3 packets of cashew nuts, snack packs from the bullet train, and gobbles one of them immediately. It isn't too stale. There's also a tin of Soyo Boy sardines. Otherwise, there's only a half-empty bottle of ketchup, dark brown and fermenting. He knows better than to open the refrigerator. Some of the smell in the kitchen is coming from there. In one of the drawers under the counter, there's a flashlight that works. He takes that and a couple of candle ends and some matches. He finds a plastic garbage bag right where it should be and puts everything into it, including the sardines and the other 2 packs of cashews and the bourbon and the soap and aspirin. There are some knives, not very sharp. He chooses 2 and a small cooking pot. That will come in handy if he can find something to cook. Down the hallway, tucked in between the kitchen and the utility room, there's a small home office. A desk with a dead computer, a fax, a printer, also a container with plastic pens, a shelf with reference books, a dictionary, a thesaurus, a Bartlett's, the Norton Anthology of Modern Poetry. The striped pajamas guy upstairs must have been a word person then. A rejuvenescent speechwriter, an ideological plumber, a spin doctor, a hair splitter for hire. Poor bugger, thinks Snowman. Beside a vase of withered flowers and a framed father and son snapshot, the child was a boy then, 7 or 8. There's a telephone scratch pad. Scrawled across the top page are the words, "Get lawn mowed." Then in smaller, fainter letters, "Call clinic." The ballpoint pen is still on the paper, as if dropped from a slackening hand. It must have come suddenly, right then, the sickness and the realization of it, both. Snowman can picture the guy figuring it out as he looked down at his own moving hand. He must have been an early case, or he wouldn't still have been worrying about his lawn. The back of his neck prickles again. Why does he have the feeling that it's his own house he's broken into? His own house from 25 years ago. Himself, the missing child. Twister. Snowman makes his way through the curtained demi-light of the living room to the front of the house, plotting his future course. He'll have to try for a house richer in canned goods, or even a mall. He could camp out there overnight, up on one of the top shelving racks. That way he could take his time, bagging only the best. Who knows? There may still be some chocolate bars. Then, when he knows he's covered the nutrition angle, he can head for the bubble dome, pilfer the arsenal. Once he's got a functional spray gun in his hands again, he'll feel a lot safer. He throws his stick out through the broken window, then climbs out himself, taking care not to rip his new flowered sheet, or cut himself, or tear his plastic bag on the jagged glass. Directly across from him on the overgrown lawn, cutting off access to the street, there's a quintuplet of pigeons, rooting around in a small heap of trash he hopes is only clothing. A boar, 2 sows, 2 young. When they hear him, they stop feeding and lift their heads. They see him, all right. He raises his stick, shakes it at them. Usually they bolt if he does that. Pigeons have long memories and sticks look like electroprods. But this time they stand their ground. They're sniffing in his direction, as if puzzled. Maybe they smell the perfume he sprayed on himself. The stuff could have analog mammalian sex pheromones in it, which would be just his luck. Trampled to death by lustful pigoons. What a moronic finish. What can he do if they charge? Only one option. Scramble back through the window. Does he have time for that? Despite the stubby legs carrying their enormous bulk, the damn things can run very fast. The kitchen knives are in his garbage bag. In any case, they're too short and flimsy to do much damage to a full-sized pigoon. It would be like trying to stick a paring knife into a truck tire. The boar lowers its head, hunching its massive neck and shoulders and swaying uneasily back and forth, making up its mind. But the others have already begun moving away, so the boar thinks better of it and follows them, marking its contempt and defiance by dropping a pile of dung as it goes. Snowman stands still until they're all out of sight, then proceeds with caution, looking frequently behind him. There are too many pigoon tracks around here. Those beasts are clever enough to fake a retreat, then lurk around the next corner. They'd bowl him over, trample him, then rip him open, munch up the organs first. He knows their tastes. A brainy and omnivorous animal, the pigoon. Some of them may even have human neocortex tissue growing in their crafty, wicked heads. Yes, there they are, up ahead. They're coming out from behind a bush, all five of them. No, all seven. They're staring in his direction. It would be a mistake to turn his back or to run. He raises the stick and walks sideways, back in the direction from which he's come. If necessary, he can take refuge inside the checkpoint gatehouse and stay there till they go away. Then he'll have to find a roundabout route to the Bubble Dome, keeping to the side streets where evasion is possible. But in the time it takes him to cover the distance, slip-stepping as if in some grotesque dance with the pigoons still staring, dark clouds have come boiling up from the south, blotting out the sun. This isn't the usual afternoon storm. It's too early, and the sky has an ominous greenish-yellow tinge. It's a twister, a big one. The pigoons have vanished now, gone to seek shelter. He stands outside the checkpoint cubicle watching the storm roll forward. It's a grand spectacle. He once saw an amateur documentary maker with a camcorder sucked right up into one of those. He wonders how Crake's children are getting along back at the shore. Too bad for Crake if the living results of all his theories are whirled away into the sky or swept out to sea on a big wave. But that won't happen. In case of high seas, the breakwaters formed by fallen rubble will protect them. As for the twister, they've weathered one of those before. They'll retreat into the central cavern in the jumble of concrete blocks they call their thunder home and wait it out. The advance winds hit, stirring up debris on the open field. Lightning zips between the clouds. He can see the thin, dark cone zigzagging downwards. Then darkness descends. Luckily, the checkpoint is built into the security building beside it, and those things are like bunkers, thick and solid. He ducks inside as the first rain strikes. There's a shrieking of wind, a crashing of thunder, a vibrating sound as everything still nailed down hums like a gear in a giant engine. A large object hits the other wall. He moves inward, through one doorway and then another, scrambling in his garbage bag for the flashlight. He's got it out and is fumbling with it when there's another gigantic crash and the overhead lights blink on. Some previously fried solar circuit must have been refried. He almost wishes the lights hadn't gone on. There's a couple of biosuits off in the corner with whatever's left inside them in a bad state of repair. Filing cabinets pulled open, paper scattered everywhere. Looks as if the guards were overwhelmed. Maybe they were trying to stop people from getting out through the gates. There was an attempt to enforce a quarantine, as he recalls. But the antisocial elements, which would have included just about everyone by then, must have broken in and trashed the secret files. How optimistic of them to have believed that any of the paperwork and storage disks might still have been of use to anyone. He forces himself to go over to the suits. He prods them with his stick, turns them over. Not as bad as he thought. Not too smelly, only a few beetles. Anything soft is mostly gone. But he can't find any weapons. The antisocials must have made off with those, as he would have done. As he did do. He leaves the inmost room, goes back to the receptionist's area, the part with the counter and the desk. All at once he's very tired. He sits down in the ergonomic chair. It's been a long time since he sat in a chair, and it feels strange. He decides to set out his matches and candle ends in case the lights go out again. While he's at it, he has a drink of birdbath water and the second package of cashews. From outside comes the howling of the wind, an unearthly noise, like a huge animal unchained and raging. Gusts are coming in, past the doors he's closed, stirring up the dust. Everything rattles. His hands are shaking. This is getting to him, more than he's allowed himself to admit. What if there are rats in here? There must be rats. What if it starts to flood? They'll run up his legs. He pulls his legs up onto the chair, folds them over one of the ergonomic arms, tucks the floral sheet around them. No hope of hearing any telltale squeaking. The racket of the storm is too loud. "A great man must rise to meet the challenges in his life," says a voice. Who is it this time? A motivational lecturer from Rejuve TV, some fatuous drone in a suit, a gabbler for hire. "This is surely the lesson taught to us by history. The higher the hurdle, the greater the jump. Having to face a crisis causes you to grow as a person." "I haven't grown as a person, you cretin," Snowman shouts. "Look at me. I've shrunk. My brain is the size of a grape." But he doesn't know which it is, bigger or smaller, because there's nobody to measure himself by. He's lost in the fog. No benchmarks. The lights go out. Now he's alone in the dark. "So what?" he tells himself. "You were alone in the light. No big difference." But there is. He's ready, though. He gets a grip. He stands the flashlight on end, strikes a match in its feeble beam, manages to light a candle. It wavers in the drafty air, but it burns, casting a small, glowing circle of soft yellow on the desk, turning the room around him into an ancient cave, dark but protective. He rummages in his plastic bag, finds the third pack of cashews, rips it open, eats the contents. He takes out the bottle of bourbon, thinks about it, then unscrews the top and drinks. Glook, 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 goes the cartoon writing in his head. Fire water. "Oh, sweetie," a woman's voice says from the corner of the room. "You're doing really well." "No, I'm not," he says. A puff of air, woof, hits his ears, blows out the candle. He can't be bothered relighting it because the bourbon is taking over. He'd rather stay in the dark. He can sense Oryx drifting towards him on her soft, feathery wings. Any moment now she'll be with him. He sits crouched in the chair with his head down on the desk and his eyes closed, in a state of misery and peace. 10. Vulturizing. After 4 deranged years, Jimmy graduated from Martha Graham with his dingy little degree in problematics. He didn't expect to get a job right away, and in this he was not deceived. For weeks he'd parcel up his meager credentials, send them out, then get them back too quickly, sometimes with grease spots and fingerprints from whatever sub-basement-level cog had been flipping through them while eating lunch. Then he'd replace the dirty pages and send the package out again. He'd snared a summer job at the Martha Graham Library, going through old books and earmarking them for destruction, while deciding which should remain on Earth in digital form. But he lost his post halfway through its term because he couldn't bear to throw anything out. After that, he shacked up with his girlfriend of the moment, a conceptual artist and long-haired brunette named Amanda Payne. This name was an invention, like much about her. Her real name was Barb Jones. She'd had to reinvent herself, she told Jimmy, the original Barb having been so bulldozed by her abusive, white-trash, sugar-overdosed family that she'd been nothing but a yard sale reject, like a wind chime made of bent forks or a three-legged chair. This had been her appeal for Jimmy, for whom yard sale was in itself an exotic concept. He'd wanted to mend her, do the repairs, freshen up the paint, make her like new. "You have a good heart," she told him the first time she'd let him inside her defenses. Revision, overalls. Amanda had a run-down condo in one of the modules, shared with 2 other artists, both men. The 3 of them were all from the Pleblands. They'd gone to Martha Graham on scholarship, and they considered themselves superior to the privileged, weak-spined, degenerate offspring of the compounds, such as Jimmy. They'd had to be tough, take it on the chin, battle their way. They claimed a clarity of vision that could only have come from being honed on the grindstone of reality. One of the men had tried suicide, which conferred on him, he implied, a special vantage. The other one had shot a lot of heroin, and dealt it too, before taking up art instead, or possibly in addition. After the first few weeks during which he'd found them charismatic, Jimmy had decided these two were bullshit technicians, in addition to which they were puffed-up snots. The two who were not Amanda tolerated Jimmy, but just marginally. In order to ingratiate himself with them, he took a turn in the kitchen now and then. All three of the artists sneered at microwaves and were into boiling their own spaghetti. But he wasn't a very good cook. He made the mistake of bringing home a Chicky Knob's bucket of nubbins one night. A franchise had opened around the corner, and the stuff wasn't that bad if you could forget everything you knew about the provenance. And after that, the two of them, who were not Amanda, barely spoke to him. That didn't stop them from speaking to each other. They had lots to say about all kinds of junk they claimed to know something about, and would drone on in an instigated way, delivering themselves of harangues and oblique sermons that were, in fact, Jimmy felt, aimed at himself. According to them, it had been game over once agriculture was invented 6 or 7,000 years ago. After that, the human experiment was doomed, first to gigantism due to a maxed-out food supply, and then to extinction once all the available nutrients had been hoovered up. "You've got the answers," said Jimmy. He'd come to enjoy needling them, because who were they to judge? The artists, who were not sensitized to irony, said that correct analysis was one thing, but correct solutions were another, and the lack of the latter did not invalidate the former. Anyway, maybe there weren't any solutions. Human society, they claimed, was a sort of monster, its main byproducts being corpses and rubble. It never learned. It made the same cretinous mistakes over and over, trading short-term gain for long-term pain. It was like a giant slug, eating its way relentlessly through all the other bioforms on the planet, grinding up life on Earth and shitting it out the backside in the form of pieces of manufactured and soon-to-be obsolete plastic junk. "Like your computers," murmured Jimmy, "the ones you do your art on?" "Soon," said the artists, ignoring him, "there would be nothing left but a series of long subterranean tubes covering the surface of the planet. The air and light inside them would be artificial, the ozone and oxygen layers of planet Earth having been totally destroyed. People would creep along through this tubing, single file, stark naked, their only view the asshole of the one before them in the line, their urine and excrement flowing down through vents in the floor, until they were randomly selected by a digitalized mechanism, at which point they would be sucked into a side tunnel, ground up, and fed to the others through a series of nipple-shaped appendages on the inside of the tube. The system would be self-sustaining and perpetual, and would serve everybody right." "So I guess that would do away with war," said Jimmy. "And we'd all have very thick kneecaps, but what about sex? Not so easy packed into a tube like that." Amanda shot him a dirty look. Dirty, but complicit. You could tell the same question had occurred to her. Amanda herself wasn't very talkative. She was an image person, not a word person, she said. She claimed to think in pictures. That was fine with Jimmy, because a bit of synesthesia never went amiss. "So what do you see when I do this?" he'd ask her in their earliest, most ardent days. "Flowers," she'd say. "Two or three. Pink." "How about this? What do you see?" "Red flowers. Red and purple. 5 or 6. "How about this? Oh, baby, I love you." "Neon." Afterwards, she would sigh and tell him, "That was the whole bouquet." He was susceptible to those invisible flowers of hers. They were, after all, a tribute to his talents. She had a very fine ass, too, and the tits were real. But, and he'd noticed this early, she was a little flinty around the eyes. Amanda was from Texas, originally. She claimed to be able to remember the place before it dried up and blew away, in which case, thought Jimmy, she was about 10 years older than she made out. She'd been working for some time on a project called Vulture Sculptures. The idea was to take a truckload of large, dead animal parts to vacant fields or the parking lots of abandoned factories and arrange them in the shapes of words, wait until the vultures had descended and were tearing them apart, then photograph the whole scene from a helicopter. She'd attracted a lot of publicity at first, as well as a few sacks of hate mail and death threats from the god's gardeners and from isolated crazies. One of the letters was from Jimmy's old dorm roommate, Bernice, who'd cranked her rhetorical volume up considerably. Then some wrinkly, corrupt old patron who'd made a couple of fortunes out of a string of heart parts farms had given her a hefty grant, under the illusion that what she was doing was razor-sharp, cutting-edge. This was good, said Amanda, because without that chunk of change, she would have had to abandon her artwork. Helicopters cost a lot of money, and then, of course, there was the security clearance. The corpsmen were really anal about airspace, she said. They suspected everyone of wanting to nuke stuff from above, and you practically had to let them climb into your underpants before they'd let you fly anywhere in a hired copter, unless you were some graft-ridden prince from a compound, that is. The words she vulturized, her term, had to have four letters. She gave a great deal of thought to them. Each letter of the alphabet had a vibe, a plus or minus charge, so the words had to be selected with care. Vulturizing brought them to life, was her concept, and then it killed them. It was a powerful process, like watching God thinking, she'd said on a net Q&A. So far she'd done pain, a pun on her last name, as she'd pointed out in chat room interviews, and whom, and then guts. She was having a hard time during the summer of Jimmy, because she was blocked on the next word. Finally, when Jimmy didn't think he could stand any more boiled spaghetti, and the sight of Amanda staring into space while chewing on a strand of her hair no longer brought on an attack of lust and rapture, he landed a job. It was with an outfit called A New You, a minor compound situated so close to one of the more dilapidated plebelands that it might as well have been in it. Not too many people would work there if they'd had other choices, was what he felt on the day he went for the interview, which might have accounted for the slightly abject manner of the interviewers. He could bet they'd been rejected by a dozen or two job hunters before him. Well, he beamed at them telepathically, I may not be what you had in mind, but at least I'm cheap. What had impressed them, said the interviewers, there were two of them, a woman and a man, was his senior dissertation on self-help books of the 20th century. One of their core products, they told him, was the improvement items. Not books anymore, of course, but the DVDs, the CD-ROMs, the websites, and so forth. It wasn't these instructionals as such that generated the cash surplus, they explained. It was the equipment and the alternative medicines you needed in order to get the optimum effect. Mind and body went hand in hand, and Jimmy's job would be to work on the mind end of things. In other words, the promotionals. What people want is perfection, said the man, in themselves. But they need the steps to it to be pointed out, said the woman. In a simple order, said the man. With encouragement, said the woman, and a positive attitude. They like to hear about the before and the after, said the man. It's the art of the possible, but with no guarantees, of course. You showed great insight into the process, the woman said. In your dissertation, we found it very mature. If you know one century, you know them all, said the man. But the adjectives change, said Jimmy. Nothing's worse than last year's adjectives. Exactly, said the man, as if Jimmy had just solved the riddle of the universe in one blinding flashbulb of light. He got a finger-cracking handshake from the man. From the woman he got a warm but vulnerable smile, which left him wondering whether or not she was married. The pay at A New You wasn't that great, but there might be other advantages. That evening he told Amanda Payne about his good fortune. She'd been carping about money lately, or not carping, but she'd inserted a few pointed remarks about pulling your own weight into the prolonged and intent silences that were her specialty, so he thought she'd be pleased. Things hadn't been that good in the sack lately, ever since his Chicky Knobs blunder, in fact. Maybe they'd pick up now, in time for a heartfelt, plangent, and action-filled finale. Already he was rehearsing his exit lines, I'm not what you need, you deserve better, I'll ruin your life, and so forth. But it was best to work up to these things, so he elaborated on his new job. Now I'll be able to bring home the bacon, he concluded, in what he hoped was a winsome but responsible tone. Amanda wasn't impressed. You're going to work where? Was her comment, point being, as it unfolded, that A New You was a collection of cesspool denizens who existed for no other reason than to prey on the phobias and void the bank accounts of the anxious and the gullible. It seemed that Amanda, until recently, had had a friend who'd signed up for a new U5-month plan, touted as being able to cure depression, wrinkles, and insomnia all at the same time, and who'd pushed herself over the edge, actually over the windowsill of her 10-story-up apartment, on some kind of South American tree bark.